The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And that is, some of you, if you didn't know, we had a Sangha member by the name of Victor Medina who passed away a little over a week ago. I didn't make the announcement last Monday, for those of you who might have known him. Sorry about that. We're going to have a memorial for him here this Sunday at 1 o'clock. And Victor was a big part of our, big volunteer in our community for many years, strong practitioner. And he kind of pretty much probably has touched in some, one way or other almost, I get a feeling almost everyone's lives who comes here who connects to Audio Dharma. Because for years he was setting it up and, you know, organizing it and kind of establishing that a whole way it's we make talks available here. So he did a great service for our community. The mood I'm in as I'm sitting here with you is simple. I don't know if simple is a mood exactly, but I don't know, in list of moods, is that allowed? I'm feeling simple. So we'll see if it's a simple talk. Certainly the hope. And one of the simple places to begin is to evoke the simplicity of mindfulness practice. There's a little kind of cliche in our scene that mindfulness is simple. What's difficult is remembering to do it. But mindfulness, to be mindful. And one of the practices of mindfulness that I find useful for myself from time to time is the practice of saying here. And the reason I find it useful when I sit down to meditate and my mind is not here, but is only there and then. And I'm thinking about other times and other places. And I'm caught up in my thoughts, so much so that I might come back for a moment to my breath, but it seems like I just go off into my thinking again. My thinking is quite strong. And When that happens, I find it's not so useful for me to keep kind of coming back to the breath, almost like in tension or in opposition to what's going on. But what I find useful is to stay simple, not to try to do too much. But what I'll do is say the word in my quietly to myself, here, just here. And I'll repeat it over and over again in a kind of easygoing, relaxed pace, here. And when I say the word here, then I become curious for a moment or two, or however long I can, to what is here? What's the experience here and now of this moment, of myself right now? And since I tend to do this saying here, at times my mind is thinking a lot, what I notice here is a person who's thinking. And then I might notice what it's like to be thinking, the energy behind it, the feelings behind it, the things, you know, what's going on. And then I'll say it again, here. And for me, the word here, in saying it, it's not like a command to a dog. Come here. And it's a little bit, it's H-E-R-E, but it's has a little spirit of here, like how do you spell it? H-A-I-R? no, that's not right, right? H-E-A-R. To hear, to listen. So to say here and then to listen. What's here? Or to notice. What is here? And the idea is to be kind of just allowing, to be very allowing and permissive, whatever is going on for me when I'm sitting down to meditate this way, to be very permissive, very allowing. I'm not trying to change anything or fix anything or get away from anything. I don't have the idea that, I'm not living with the idea that it's wrong to have a mind that's spinning out. I'm a bad person or a bad meditator. I just kind of say here in the middle of that, and then I just notice what it's like to be that way for however long I can, which may be not very long, because I have these very important things to think about. And so then I'll say it again here. I'm not in conflict with what's going on. I'm just kind of placing myself in the middle of it here and now to notice what is here. And the idea of being present without being in conflict with oneself is one of the great pleasures of life. It's one of the great things. To not feel like you have to fix or change or be bad or push away, but also that you don't have to indulge in it either. You have to fix and do something, get something done. But just as very simple, kind of here. And then what is here? Notice, this is what it's like now. This is what it's like now. And so what happens for me when I do this is after a while doing it, the momentum of my thinking begins to abate. I'm not giving a lot of energy to continuing to think. Thinking might be going on, but part of me has disengaged with the thinking because I'm just noticing what it's like to be here. Part of me is engaged in noticing, not in thinking. And so the fuel for the thinking begins to abate. And when it's quiet enough that I'm not being kind of pulled around by the nose, by my thoughts, then I'll stop saying here and I'll come back. And usually for me, what it means then is I come and center myself in my breathing. But then I center myself in the breathing without struggling against something else because the other stuff has abated enough. One of the things that this simple practice of saying here and just opening up and feeling and noticing what is here can do for you is to give you a visceral sense of what it's like to not be in conflict with your experience. Whether you're feeling, whether you're spinning out in thoughts or whether you're feeling angry or you're filled with desire or you're restless or you're filled with doubt or you're sitting in pain. There's a lot of things that can happen here in the present moment. And this little word here, and then opening to feel that for even a few instances can be an experience of not being in conflict with that. It can be very powerful to do with pain. Pain, for many people, have very strong habitual reactions to. And pain can be quite monumental and difficult to be with, especially if it persists over time. I'm thinking of physical pain, but also emotional pain. But here, and just opening for an instant, is not meant to be a long-term solution. It's not meant to be something you could do for a long time, but for a couple of instances, perhaps you can kind of step back or relax or open up and allow without conflict. And that sense of experiencing what's going on without conflict and getting a sense of the value of that, the possibility of that, is something that's really good to let it register, like appreciate that. Well, this is what it's like not to be in conflict. Many people spend their lives in conflict, wanting things to be different, wanting something that they don't have, not wanting what they want, what they have, regretting, upset, angry, all kinds of things going on that represent not being at ease and at peace with this moment here. So perhaps if you do this kind of here practice, it points to this getting a hint or a sense of what it's like to sit without being in conflict. The other thing that can happen is you sit with any kind of mindfulness practice, but with this here practice, is you might notice how difficult it is to be here. You might notice how many judgments and ideas and feelings you have about how things should be different, one way or the other. That it's not that common for your mind to just be content and happy with how it is right now. So, if you notice that, what should you do? Get upset? I'm a bad meditator. I was supposed to sit here and not be in conflict with the present moment and be here in the present moment. This is proof that I am a bad meditator. I guess I should just bear down more or whip myself into shape or see what's on the television. So I'd like to make a very, what I think, significant statement, a provocative statement for you. And that is that insight practice, the practice of mindfulness meditation leading to insight, the insight practice, which is a practice of moving towards freedom, that the path of, let me say it a little differently, so the path of freedom begins when you recognize you're having trouble meditating. Isn't that provocative? That the path of freedom begins when you notice that you have trouble meditating, being, you have trouble being in the present moment, trouble being focused, trouble being here. Are you properly provoked? So why do you think I said that? Why do you think that was so important to say in such a strong way? How is it that the path of freedom opens, begins, when you have trouble being present? If you can use the mic, please. Here behind you. The green light. Can you say your name first?
Samir, I think it's very provocative and important to start there because that's what's real.
So that's what's real. So the path of freedom starts where it's real, not where it's fantasy. Good. Someone else? Yes, you? Even pass the mic back there. No, so some people have hearing assistant devices and they can't hear if. We want everyone to be able to hear. And excuse me, the green light.
Oh, hi, I'm Cece. I think once you start to accept that you are having a hard time meditating, then there is that that freedom of...
Then there's what?
That freedom.
That freedom right there. So that in acceptance of it, not being in conflict, but seeing it clearly, there begins to be freedom. Okay, good. Straight back in the back, outer hall. Yeah, please say your names so that we...
Abraham, I think when you see how difficult it is to be present, you start to appreciate how conditioned your mind is to following every little whim. And that's a wonderful realization to see how caught you are and not free.
It sounds painful to me. Why is it wonderful?
Because if you continue practicing, with time, your ability to be present even with the distractions grows.
So if you can recognize how distracted you are, how caught you are, then there's a possibility of outgrowing that and moving with that, moving through it. Good, thank you. So someone up here on the stage?
For me, I can imagine, my name is William.
If you hold it vertically, then people, because you like that, yeah, you have to talk into the top of it.
Thank you. For me, I can imagine that that becoming the object of my attention, I detach from it and become less connected or invested in the difficulty with meditation, and it by itself can become a focus for my meditation, which will be an aid to me rather than a detriment.
Beautiful, wonderful answer. So one of the ways of not being free is to have your attention hijacked by your concerns, by your preoccupations. If you claim your attention, engage it by using your attention to focus on the very thing which is a distraction, the very distracted tendency, then you're claiming your freedom. You're finding your freedom in it. So this is kind of this judo move where you clearly see the very thing which is the problem that's keeping you caught, and then you're not so caught anymore. Just something like that you were saying, right?
Tom, when you said that, what popped into my mind was... Tom. So when you said that, popped into my mind was the truth will set you free. And
how does that work?
Well, by seeing things as they are.
So when we see things clearly for what they are, then it sets us free. Yeah. So it's more we're not so easily fooled by things if we see clearly what they are. But if we don't look at things clearly, don't stop and really look, it's easy to have fantasies about it, think it's important, it's easy to be blinded by it, all kinds of things. Anything else? Please.
My name is Sonia, and I'm thinking it's about awareness. The difference, when you said, when you realize how difficult it is to meditate, that's when you begin the road to freedom. I probably said it backwards. But so what struck me is that if you never become aware that you're not here, then you're not on the road.
That's right. You're not on the road at all. Thank you. Back behind you there.
My name's Scott. And I guess I think I react to that. It's kind of simple. You can't solve a problem if you don't acknowledge that you've got the problem.
Great.
So if you're having a hard time meditating and you go watch TV, you're not acknowledging you got the problem. So you're not going to follow that path. You're on a different path.
Great. Wonderful. These are great responses. Thank you. So one of the ways, one of the things that's very important in doing mindfulness practice is not to be too preoccupied or caught up in ideal and idealism. And one of the ways we can get caught up in idealism for meditators is to focus too much on having a good meditation experience, is to think that there's some great, wonderful, deep, concentrated state, some wonderful experience of cosmic consciousness, some bliss, something. Because what happens then is that it's easy then to overlook the careful mindfulness of the very thing that's making it difficult to be present. The forces of distraction, the forces of desire and aversion that operate, that make the whole meditation difficult or make being present difficult, that puts us in conflict with our experience, is something that's very important to understand. And a big part of the wisdom, traditionally in Buddhism, is to the wisdom to understand how we get caught, to understand how desire operates within us, to understand how aversion operates within us, so to keep us caught and trapped and perpetuating the cycles of distractions, distractibility, and all this. And so by recognizing when meditation doesn't work, because you can study what's going on more carefully. And generally in Buddhism, in shorthand, we say generally it's two primary mental forces operating. Something fits under the categories of desires, or something that fits under the category of aversion. And somehow that's behind or fueling the activity of being caught, being attached, being preoccupied with whatever we're preoccupied with. And so the task of people who do mindfulness meditation is when it should happen, the rare occasion, when you find yourself caught up in something, is to very contentedly study that phenomena. Get to know it better. Don't be in a hurry to fix it. Don't be in a hurry to overcome the distracted mind or what's going on that kind of keeps you caught in some preoccupation. But can you turn your attention towards it? And in turning your attention towards it, a number of things happen. One of the things happens, as I said earlier, you begin taking some control of your awareness itself. Rather than having your awareness taken over by your concerns and blinded by it, you're beginning to take a little bit of charge of your own experience. I'm going to pay attention to this, you say, rather than being lost in it. And that kind of taking charge like that is a very important thing. Generally in Buddhism, Buddhist meditation circles, eventually we don't like the language of taking charge. But provisionally it's a good idea, you know, to do this. And then as we begin, and then we can, once we're kind of applying our attention to look at the distractions and difficulties, then we can start learning what they are more carefully. And one of the big tasks for people on the path of freedom in Buddhism is to become really familiar with how their mind desires things, how desire functions in our minds. What tricks does desire have for you? What are the things you desire? How do you get hooked into desire? What's the energy that gets involved when you have desire? What are the beliefs that are involved when you have desire? What's the self-identity that comes into play when you have desire? And the same thing with aversion. If you really have aversion, hostility, ill will, you really dislike something, look at that, study that. What's that like? What's going on inside of you? Really look at it. As you spend time looking at it well, you're strengthening this capacity to take charge. If you can look at it without adding aversion on top of aversion or desire on top of desire, if you can stay very simple, this is why the idea of simplicity is so important. We want to look at it carefully, but we want to stay very simple. We want to look at what goes on and not be in conflict with it. We don't look at what's going on, and there's no need to add a layer of self-identification on top of it. This means I'm bad. This means that I'm this kind of person. It's possible, rather than saying, "Oh, I'm a desirous person," or that didn't come across right. I'm a desiring person. Sometimes I have trouble with English. I'm a desiring person. If a person has desire, it's much simpler to just say, recognize there's desire operating. To add the layer, I'm a person with desire, makes it more complicated than it needs to be. It's very simple, just say there's desire happening. And then look and see how it operates. And part of the reason to stop and look at all this carefully is that the more familiar we are with how this works, the more we can see the subtlety of how it works. We can see the tricks of how it works. Even very good meditators, so-called good meditators who have deep, quiet, focused experiences, desire and aversion can still be operating. But they operate so subtly that they don't see how they operate until they kind of trip over it and crash and fall. And so by learning, taking the time to get familiar with it, then we can recognize it more readily when it happens. And one of the places where I think it's very useful to see, for example, desire, really recognize what desire is like, and recognize that is that there are some people who confuse spiritual freedom with the unhindered freedom to act on desires. Where we have desires, and the idea of freedom is to not have anything in the way of fulfilling those desires. The freedom to shop. You know, if you just have an unlimited credit card, that's freedom. But desire is still operating, and when desire is unhindered and you can pursue an unhindered way of your desire, you don't see the cost. You don't see how there's a loss of freedom, spiritual freedom, in that kind of being pulled away by it. But if you really understand how desire works, you're not going to be tricked into the idea that unhindered desire is a kind of freedom. The same thing can happen with a little bit with aversion. I have a sense that some people who have tremendous capacity for very clear, very determined conviction behind their aversion, great clarity and precision and incisive, confident aversion, sometimes can think that they're really wise, can think that there's a kind of awakening and being in that kind of clarity of the aversion. But if you're really taking time to get to know and understand how aversion works, then you might notice when that strong conviction around your aversion is operating that, oh, there's aversion happening. Some people are much better at having desires than aversions, and some people are much better at having aversions than desires. It's probably best not to take one kind of person as being better or worse than others. But in case the people tend to focus on the aversion type, usually desire is kind of pleasant, you know, kind of. Aversion tends to be more painful, and aversion tends to be less socially accepted than desire, so I'll kind of give a plug for aversion. In the Buddhist tradition, it's said that it's more dangerous to have an aversive personality than a desiring personality. It's more dangerous because you can do more harm in the world. But it's more beneficial as a practitioner because you're less patient with your shenanigans in your mind. So you're not going to put up with it. You're more likely to kind of, you know, come back with and, you know, continue with your path. So, part of the task of people on a path of freedom is to understand how you're not free. Some people find this kind of discouraging because they would rather live in utopia. They'd rather live in some wonderful bliss state or wonderful place that there's no problems at all. But I think that there is freedom to be experienced. There is wonderful states to be experienced. But the freedom which is wise is freedom that comes with understanding. Understands how the mind works. Understands the tricks of the mind. Because the chances are very, very, very good that if you have some experience of spiritual freedom, that it's not going to last that long. And if it's not going to last that long, sooner or later you're going to find yourself not so free, caught up again in your desires and your aversions, your thoughts and all that. And so if you've taken your time to study and get familiar with how you're not free, then when you lose your freedom, you're familiar with the territory. You know how to work with it. You're not going to be tricked and fooled by it or get upset by it so quickly. You can work with it. You have the tools and the ability to keep working with it. And this ability to keep coming back and working wisely with how we actually are in any given situation is one of the great gifts of this practice, to have those tools. And if the focus is too much on freedom and not on how we are not free, we won't develop those tools, we won't develop that understanding, those insights of what goes on. So generally it's useful, especially when people are practicing mindfulness, to not be on the spiritual fast track. Take your time. Remember, it's supposed to be simple. It isn't really that different than being here. Just here. Here. What's this? And in fact, there's a kind of a freedom in the moment of saying here and then opening yourself up to recognize and see what is here without conflict. There's a freedom, a teeny, small freedom there. And to begin kind of recognizing that and using that space to begin looking more deeply at what goes on in the structures of our minds, how we get caught, our attachments, our clingings, our aversions. Then we develop the wisdom that makes freedom more realistic and more useful. So, and this is why the path of freedom, for meditation, the path of freedom begins when the meditation doesn't work. Isn't that good news? Can't you just wait to go home and meditate now and can't you look forward to when it doesn't work? Now, when it does work, whatever that means, just be happy with that. But when it doesn't work, be happy with that. You can't lose. If you take whatever is happening in the moment as the material of practice, take whatever is happening in the moment as what you can explore, be present for. So I hope that made enough sense. So now we have about 10 minutes. If you have any questions about this or comments or testimonials.
Someone out there has
the... Maybe you can move that, to kind of pass that one forward in the stage so it's closer. Green light.
You've spoken a lot about thoughts and how being present is a way to respond to that. What is your opinion on emotions and whether or not this can actually be a way of centering yourself during that?
I think it works pretty much the same way. Sometimes emotions are the predominant thing that we get caught in, sometimes attached to, something being pushed around by, involved with. And so the same thing there. Hear and just feel the emotional body. Feel what's going on and the feelings in the body and make space for it. Sometimes people are very claustrophobic around the emotions. Sometimes they're really big and troublesome. And a moment of mindfulness can create a little bit of space around it and make it a lot easier. And then to look at the emotions, study those and get familiar with them. It's a hugely important part of this practice as well. Since the contrast you made to emotions was my discussions about thoughts. There's not a strong absolute separation between the world of thinking and the world of emotions. The two kind of come together, work together. So if you go deeply into the world of thoughts, you probably at some point come into the world of emotions. If you go deeply into the world of emotions, you come into the world of thoughts. They come out to each other. You have to look at both of them. Yes, over in the corner.
When you talk about understanding how the mind works and going deep into the feelings and the emotions, but more how the mind works, is that a rational exercise, or is it meditation, or is it contemplation? What could you give some more light on?
Very good question. Generally, in the mindfulness meditation, we don't think about things, we don't analyze things that way, we don't go deep that way, but we rely more on the ability of silent observation or silent presence. We bring greater presence to the experience. So if there's a strong emotion, there's no need to be thinking about it or figuring it out and what's going on that way, but rather to feel it more deeply in the body. So where is it in the body? And then with a kind of silent feeling, a silent observation, let it register more fully what that experience is like. And as we do that kind of deeper registration, deeper feeling, deeper sense of silent observation of it, whatever needs to be revealed about it will reveal itself. We don't have to go. We don't have to be the one who figures it out. It's more it gets revealed. We see with as we go into it.
So that's when you have. That's why when you have a problem with meditation, that's the good news that you have something to experience more in that type of level.
Yes, exactly. If you have problem with meditation, so if you have problem with your meditation, you know whatever that means. You want to study that. You want to be present for what that difficulty feels like in the present moment. You don't need to go start thinking about it and trying to solve it in your mind, but rather what's happening in the present moment that's making it difficult. You know, what's taking you away? What's grabbing your attention? What's spinning you out? All the way in the outer hall,
So, as I turn and look at my aversion and my desire, and really look at it, and kind of turn and face myself as I experience these things, what I'm increasingly aware of is that it seems to come from a lack of confidence in myself, in doubt in myself, and that when I really am within myself, the aversion and the desire drop away because there's nothing more needed and there's, you know, whatever the aversive state is, there's, you know, it becomes unimportant. And so, you know, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about self-doubt as a major hindrance, because as I continue to practice, that actually seems to me like it's more the foundation.
For you. Great.
For me,
I think it's wonderful to see that. So there's layers in our psyche and our minds. And so as we stay present, we don't have to analyze or figure out. Just very quietly, this kind of not in conflict. Just be with this experience. An image that I use occasionally for some people is that of cupping your hands together like you're going to hold something precious. Just like bring your attention underneath your experience, whatever's happening, and hold it there gently as if it's allowed to be there. So, and then it kind of reveals itself, it shows itself, or the outer elements of it relax and soften. And so for you, you started with desire and aversion, and that began to fall away or open up, and you saw that the roots of that was your self-doubt. So that's great. So then do the same thing with self-doubt. Go and bring careful attention to that and hold that in your hand of awareness and just be with it. The tremendous value in just being with things. The analogy might be, you know, if you're having a difficult time in your life and a friend just comes and sits with you and just with you. They don't solve anything for you. They don't probe into you, try to figure out what's going on. They're just there with you. And it's really meaningful as you kind of relax. So we offer that kind of, in meditation, that's the kind of quiet, silent being with ourselves that we offer. So you be with the self-doubt. Another kind of idea that I offer people sometimes is the idea of place yourself, find out where the feelings of doubt are in your body. Generally, these things have a location. So is there a location, you know, and the location could, I mean, it's probably not happening in your little toe. And so it's probably, you know, is it above your waist? Is it below your neck or is it in your head? Or, you know, where is it in your body approximately? And then when you find the location for it, where it more or less is associated, where there's energy around it, imagine you sit yourself down right in the middle of it and are quiet. Sit in the middle of the doubt and be quiet. And stay there. And see what happens.
Joel, the sense of sitting here quietly while you're meditating and your mind's distracted and going different places is an audio cue. What about something kinesthetic, like if, you know, there's some teachers I've talked to who say, you know, props can be okay. Certainly what? It's props.
Props.
Props. So what if I had a little plaque or a little card or something I held with me and it was a kinesthetic cue and it said here?
It's okay. I mean, the most common kinesthetic thing that traditionally in Buddhism people use is a mala, a rosary, and they just kind of move it through their fingers and, you know, so to remind them. You know, a prop is a good thing. It can be a useful thing. See, remember when I talked about using it, I use this here only when my mind is so spinning out that it's anything else doesn't seem to be useful. And then I stop doing it once I'm present. There, all kinds of things can be supportive that way to bring you kind of in the present moment in a good way. But what this kind of prop, if you call it prop of here, does, it helps me to do it by putting me in the middle of my experience. Someone else might say, well, I like listening to music, and that really puts me. But what music does, it does put you in the present moment, but you bypass the challenges you have. You relax and bypass rather than sitting in the middle of the challenges and facing them. And I kind of, so it's fine to do that. Sometimes that's useful to get a little bit grounded and then turn off the music and then be present for what's there. But I really like the idea of having some support that helps you put you right in the middle of what's actually happening and not bypassing anything.
Thank you.
Okay. So, well, thank you. And if you don't have a good meditation this week, I hope you have a bad one. So that you have something to study, something to look at. Thank you.